Okay, so that's the theory part.
Let me go through a few quick examples to show you exactly how this works, and then I'll give you some time for questioning. Here's a really trite example. Who here voted in the last election? I'm hoping that almost all the hands go up, because otherwise I'll be very disappointed. I'm not going to ask who you voted for, because that might get unnecessarily messy. I don't want to put forward a particular political agenda. But often, whether we're left-wing or right-wing, that informs our reaction to what people on the other wing of the political arm are actually doing. So, for example, if I'm an ardent communist, and I'm looking at what National's doing, now it's in power, I may start to attribute some rather uncharitable motivations or intentions to what my political opponents are actually up to. And most of us do this to a certain extent. You read the paper, oh God, the Labour Party, nanny state interfering once again, or oh, National once again, they're feeding riches to their mates or leaving us hanging and drying. Hanging and drying? Oh dear, I'm not quite sure what I can take. A sip of water, I think it's the throat going dry. But this is a kind of conspiratorial thinking. This is a kind of low-level conspiracy theorizing that we do on a day-by-day basis. Now, because I've defined conspiracy theory in this non-pejorative sense, we should be happy to embrace such conspiracy theorizing. Sometimes it even turns out to be warranted. One of the great things about politics is the realization that every so often they are out to get you. They are doing things behind closed doors, which are, you know, not really in your favor whatsoever. There's a certain warrant to this kind of conspiracy theorizing. You just don't want it to go too far, like your Alex Jones or your Glenn Becks, who take their conspiracy theorizing to a really quite extraordinarily rabid level. So that's a really low-level trite one. Here's a more sophisticated one. This came up when I was at the conference last year. There was some discussion as to whether the peer review system is in fact conspiratorial, whether there's a conspiracy theory operating in peer review. I'm going to do a bit of guilt by association here. The kinds of people who think there is a conspiracy theory operating in peer review are people just like this, intelligent design advocates, medical practitioners, Holocaust denials. If you think there's a conspiracy operating in the peer review system, one of the things you need to address is why your perfectly legitimate query is going to be lumped in with all these other people who engage in criticism of the peer review system. Peer review system keeps these people out. Why is it they're keeping you out as well? And it's a little unclear as to what the conspiracy in this kind of conspiracy theory actually entails. Is it the allegation there's a political bias operating there? If you think there's a political bias in the peer review system, you probably are going to have to buy into some larger New World Order-like conspiracy theory. You need to be able to explain why the peer review system doesn't change, even though major powers go in and out of control of the Earth. So what meta-government or metaphysical force is actually operating in the background. So if you are going to buy a peer review skeptical hypothesis or conspiracy theory, you need to explain how that relates to the world as a larger whole. You might think that actually the bias is heuristic, so it's in regard to truth. If you think the bias is towards producing good science and well-earned papers, that's not really a conspiracy theory. That's an explicit aim of the peer review system, to go through all the information that exists in the world, winnow it out, engage in a dialectic, decide which are the best inferences versus which are the worst. Presumably, if you have a conspiracy theory in regards to the heuristic direction of peer review, you're going to allege that actually it's non-truth conducive, or it's designed to create falsities about the world. And presumably, if that's the kind of conspiracy theory that you, and I'm talking here, you as in not anyone in this room, but you as in a potential person listening to this talk, then you probably don't understand the peer review system, because the peer review system is based upon our notion of what epistemic authorities are and how they work in larger communities. Now, this doesn't mean that there are problems with the peer review system, but it does indicate that there's not really, well, it does indicate there may not be a malevolent conspiracy operating in the background, given our understanding, and also the opaqueness, not perfect transparentness, but the opaqueness of the peer review system allows for it to actually to operate in a fairly truth-conducive, veristic way.
So you have sort of plausible rival theories to explain the presence of this kind of conspiracy theory. A lot of people, like advocates of intelligent design, who criticize the peer review system, simply aren't writing papers that survive the peer review process. They're the kind of people who put forward papers arguing for the effectiveness of homeopathy, and then scientists go, well, hold on, but where's your evidence? You can't just insist it's true. Where's the actual evidence to show your claim is good? And a lot of people who are critics of peer review are people who just simply don't write papers that pass muster. And there are a certain subset of people who write peer review papers who simply don't like being criticised. I am in the process of submitting articles to journals around the place, and sometimes you get a response back. You go, why don't you understand my brilliance? And sometimes they understand your brilliance because you're not a particularly good writer. Or sometimes you get one small criticism, well, I'm not sending the paper back to them, they don't appreciate me. Or something of that type. And the non-conspiracy theory about peer review fits in with our notion of epistemic authorities. Now, my final example, which is the one which may cause some concern, anthropogenic climate change skepticism. This is something that also came up at the last conference. There seems to be, within the skeptical community as a whole, some, what I would say, and actually following in John's words, some unwarranted skepticism in regard to particular issues just like this. So climate change skepticism, I take it to be an exemplar of a conspiracy theory. Of course, not everyone who's a skeptic of climate change is going to be a conspiracy theorist, but a large number of skeptics, of many conspiracy theorists, are going to be climate change skeptics. So, overlapping Venn diagrams. Like I should have a Venn diagram up there. The kind of agenda that gets alleged in this kind of conspiracy theory is the New World Order. So, engineer the appearance of catastrophic climate change and therefore instill a one world government operating in the background made of the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, probably the Council for Rome, all sorts of other groups operating in the background, agreeing where they never seem to have agreed in the first place. The other one which is common is the so-called green totalitarianism, or the notion that green is the new red, that actually the environmental movement is in fact old-style KGB communism. So actually, you know, the greenies are in fact actually communists, and they're just going to wait for the right moment, and then it's going to be Stalin and Mao Zedong all over again. So this is the kind of agenda that gets being put forward by this particular kind of conspiracy theory. And interesting enough, many climate change skeptics are also peer review skeptics. So a lot of the argumentation in regard to climate change skepticism is saying, oh, well, you know, the right kind of reports about what's really happening with the environment are being quashed by journals. No one's publishing the real science. They're establishing an elaborate facade of what's really going on to try and convince us to go for a new world order or to allow the communists to come and invade my bedroom again. So we can actually compare and contrast climate change skepticism along with acceptance of anthropogenic climate change and see how the two rivals fare. The official theory, which is that actually the climate is changing and it is largely due to anthropogenic sources, is non-conspiratorial. It uses epistemic authorities like the IPCC, science bodies and so forth. It's part of a continuing debate, so whilst a lot of the science is to some extent settled, there's still a debate as to how bad it might get and what kind of mitigation we might be able to bring forward. And it's a continuing debate because it uses the best sciences of our day, and those sciences are subject to change as we learn more about the world, its feedback mechanisms and the like. Whilst the climate change view, the skepticism view, is conspiratorial, and that it alleges peer review fraud, political interference, and it often presents mere authorities as epistemic authorities. And actually a great example of this actually comes from a recent book by Ian Wishart, who is the arch conspiracy theorist. Jonathan Eisen is actually the arch conspiracy theorist in our country. Ian Wishart is a very, very close second. He wrote a book called Aircon, which was the refutation of climate change science. He also wrote a book called Eve's Bite, which is the proof that God is in the details and intelligent design is in fact advocated by
great minds such as Sarah Palin and the like, the kind of experts who tell us actually that intelligent design is true, and that modern biologists know this, but they're not willing to publish about it. And it got this rather stunning blurb by a local UN IPCC expert reviewer who seemed to think that the writer of Eve's Bite, that God is in the details, is highly qualified to be able to write a book on the science of climate change. And you can learn more about this from Ian Wishart's website, which is very, very bewildering reading, even at the best of times. And I'll provide PDFs of these things for people to actually look at and actually go and investigate this further. Let me conclude. So I've highlighted what I take to be two particular problems for conspiracy theories: the attribution of intentionality and the vague notion of what the conspiratorial end goal is. And I think because of this, the inference to conspiracy is really, really hard to discharge as the burden of proof. To actually show a conspiracy is going on, you've got to do an awful lot of work. Now, there are examples of historically verified conspiracies, as I mentioned. The death of Julius Caesar is a great example. Probably the most epic and interesting example of the 20th century were the Moscow show trials in the 1930s, where Stalin and his cronies spent 9 months torturing people to manufacture testimony to thus allow them to indict and eventually assassinate Leon Trotsky. The KGB declassified the documents in 1956. It's a very clear case of a very, very large and actually quite awkwardly welded conspiracy that did actually go on. But you need to do a lot of work to actually show that your belief in a conspiracy now is actually warranted. You need to be able to show the intentionality, you need to be able to show exactly what the end goal was, and how you go about satisfying that by the action of the conspirators. And what's important for me as an epistemologist is that all this discussion is based around what it is rational for us to believe at a particular point in time. So it's very easy for us to dismiss large amounts of conspiracy theories. But as skeptics, we should allow for the fact that information may come to hand that actually shows the conspiracy theory may be warranted after all. And I'll go back to the Trotsky trials for this. The Trotsky trials were shown up to be a fraud and a conspiracy by the Dewey Commission back in 1936. So John Dewey, a very famous American philosopher, led a commission of like-minded peers in America. They argued that actually all the evidence was in fact essentially inconsistent. People weren't in places they claimed to be. Trotsky wasn't where he was said to be at the time, and the trials must be a sham. The government of the US, the government of the UK, and the government of Russia all said, no, you are mere conspiracy theorists. It was an honest trial. We prosecuted these people correctly. Their death sentences were warranted. And yet in 1956, when Khrushchev takes over from Stalin, he admits to the General Assembly, actually it was a conspiracy. And the Dewey Commission was right on almost every single matter of fact. So their conspiracy theory was in fact justified. They just didn't discharge the burden of proof to the government at the time, who took their trust in Russia to be something which preempted their ability to look at the actual arguments. So I shouldn't say they didn't discharge the burden of proof. They actually did discharge the burden of proof, but minds looked elsewhere and thought they'd rather trust political agents rather than good-minded skeptics and philosophers at that particular time. And that's the danger we have when dealing with conspiracy theories. We can have a rational reason to dismiss a lot of them, but we need to be sufficiently open-minded to take in new evidence as it comes to hand. That's the end of my talk. I've got a nice useful slide for question time if you want to deal with any of my definitions and things. But that's me shutting up now.
Well, we know why he's got such a long name, because he can get away with it, can't he? So pause for a drink, Matthew.
Thank you.
I'm sure there are some questions, and I'll just take them in a normal manner. Sort of as you'll know when it's your turn. Starting with me, actually, if you don't mind, because my question is about the secrecy. Your definition required that this conspirators did it in secret, yes?
Yes.
Is it possible that the conspirators are conspiring in secret without realising they are? And they think that they're being transparent, but actually they have an agenda which they don't discuss, and therefore, then they introduce their moves, and then a conspiracy theorist is justified in calling it a conspiracy.
Noam Chomsky has actually written on this. So yeah. Chomsky, I'm not actually the biggest fan of Chomsky, but I think he has a particularly good point when it comes to talk about what he calls institutional institutional analysis, where you have situations where large groups act with their vested interests, and they have unspoken agreements as to exactly what they want to do and how they're going to go about it, and yet to outsiders it looks as if they're actually acting in a really conspiratorial way. And the great example of this is Microsoft in the antitrust litigation that went on. People accused Microsoft of conspiring against consumers. And Microsoft's response was, oh no, we're not conspiring against consumers. We're such a large organization that when you as a small developer ring up and say, look, I need API access to X, Y, and Z, they go, I don't deal with this. You need to talk to Carol. I'll put you through to Carol. And Carol goes, No, that's really John's expertise. And you get shuffled about so much because the organization is so large and people just don't want to deal with your particular problem. It looks as if they're actually trying to deliberately shut you out as opposed to just acting with vested self-interest with no conspiratorial motivation in the background. Of course, any conspiracy theorist worth their salt will go, well, of course, that's what they want you to be. Yes. What better way to hide a conspiracy than by saying, oh, it's not a conspiracy at all, it's just the function of our large-scale organisation. Yes, yes. Can we get away with this? Yes, we can. Excellent.
I think that's called, it's not a conspiracy, it's a cock-up.
Yes.
Right. Okay, Vicky.
Just before I came up to the conference, I released the Bent Spoon announcement, which included in it various commentary about our giving the Bent Spoon to a documentary on 1080, The Poisoning of Paradise. And I mentioned in the announcement that I had had some interest in this area as I'd served 8 years on the Possum Biocontrol Bioethics Committee, looking at ways of getting rid of possums. In amongst the valedictions and vituperation I got in my email responding to the release, I had one person who said, "Huh, you're just making an appeal to authority," by mentioning my background. Can I go back and say, yes, but I'm an epistemic authority?
Well, I mean, presumably, given A, your work within a community, presumably you weren't, say, like Bob McCroskey, a one-person committee organizing part of a larger committee of people, and given your sufficient training, you say, yes, I am making an appeal to authority, but it's legitimate in this case, because I'm the right kind of authority. I have this expertise, I'm part of a like-minded group of peers and the like. So yes, it's an appeal to authority, but this one's not fallacious. Sorry, you have to try again.
It seems to me that conspiracy theories are getting more and more popular. I mean, there's a lot of money in conspiracy theories. I mean, I'm willing to bet, for example, that before long someone will say Michael Jackson's alive and well and living in Florida or something like that.
How do you know this?
There's a lot of money in them, and do you think they're sort of getting a greater frequency of them in our society?
Yes. Two things about that. One, you're right, there is a lot of money in them. I do keep trying to look out for a plausible conspiracy theory I can call my own, ditch the whole critical thinking part and just go in the lecture circuit for the rest of the time. There is very good money on being in the lecture circuit for going around promoting conspiracy theories. Not much money in debunking them, truth be told. But yes, they do seem to be becoming more popular. Steve Clark, who's an Australian philosopher, wrote a paper on this recently. And his argument is actually the vague end goal notion of conspiracy theories is actually relatively new. Prior to the internet, conspiracy theorists by and large would actually posit quite specific lists of people and their conspiracies and what they were up to, because you'd write the book would be published, and it would take 2 or 3 years for substantial criticism to emerge. With the internet now, of course, you can posit a conspiracy theory now, and in 5 minutes' time someone will be saying, oh, but what about this, what about that? So it's actually in your interest to proliferate conspiracy theories of a very vague notion, because they're very hard to falsify, But they're also very easy to satisfy. People will find lots of evidence for them, and that then seems to create a culmination effect where other people go, oh, that relates to another conspiracy theory I've heard, and they aggregate, get larger, bigger and bigger. I mean, David Icke's a great example of this. David Icke has 17 species of shape-shifting reptiles in his conspiracy theory now, because he's never heard conspiracy theory, he wasn't immediately willing to believe in.
Matthew, we'll stop now because lunchtime approaches.
You can talk to me.
Yes.
I talk to the break.
Fine.
Matthew, thank you so much. That was fascinating. And a gift on our
thank you. Thank you so much.